Committee to order. Thank you all for showing up on this lovely Monday morning. We're going to go out of order on these, and I think the first bill. I want to do is I'll open a work session on House Bill 3515. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 3515 is a replacement amendment. What you should have in front of you is the Dash 2 amendments dated 52803. The Dash 2 amendments direct the Department of Human Services to establish an automated online provider payment submission system for medical assistance program. It also directs the department to contract with an organization with expertise in the automated online provider payment submission systems. It also directs the department to create a committee 90 days after the effective date if this amendment should be adopted and enacted, and it specifies the membership of that committee. It has an emergency clause and it has an effective date of July 1, 2003. Shorten it even tighter. This is a third-party payer amendment, which reflects the presentation that we have from Digital Healthcare Incorporated. That is the type of automated system that this amendment is looking at. This will go to Ways and Means.
And I'd also point out that as an added carrot, members, I have here a letter from Digital Healthcare, which basically says that the first few states in are going to get this initially for free. So, or there's guarantees because there's going to be a surety bond to. That's how confident they are that they can increase the collections. So, and if you remember. This would allow us to do the collections on the front end rather than the back end to make sure that third party insurance programs were billed before OMAP, and this would also allow us to go after collections no matter how much they are, because currently they don't chase anything under $1,000. So.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. That's what I want to say.
Thank you. Is this the program that we had talked about and no other state had done it yet? And is that the one? And so there would be incentives for the first state to try something like this?
Actually representing the first few states, I think. And what is going to trigger this is... when HIPAA becomes fully operative in October. So that's kind of the system they're looking at.
Mr. Chair, I have a question too.
Comey.
Thank you. So I'm a little bit confused. So this committee is going to be set up that will be looking into this. And so to whom will they make the recommendation that it be implemented? And when would that be implemented?
Well, The bill is permissive on the department even doing it, but it's mandatory that this committee be set up. The timeline would be to have this in place when HIPAA takes effect in October. That's the timeline I'm hoping we would be driving to, or the committee would be driving the department to.
Got it. Thank you.
But like I said, we aren't in the bill requiring this contract, and which I thought was appropriate simply because we think the numbers work, but if they don't, we don't want to be tied to something that's not workable.
Got it.
So,
thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seemed to me that they had several other states on the line at the time, so we might be second or third.
Well, Representative, as I understand it, it's not just the first state, it's the first few.
Right.
Idaho is looking at it, several other states are looking at it. So I think this is an aggressive move that may actually save us some money in the health plan. So, Any other questions?
At this point in time, Mr. Chair, you don't see a fiscal.
The bill is going to Ways and Means. So they can this will fit into the matrix of decisions down there. So if it's going to the floor, we wait for one. But since how it's going to the place where fiscals come from, I'm fairly comfortable with that.
You ready for a motion, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, I am.
We're on 3515.
Yes,
and we need a motion on the dash two amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 3515.
Representative Wessler moves the dash two amendment into House Bill 3515. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3515 as amended by the dash twos to the floor with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Westland moves House Bill 3515 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion.
Just a comment.
Representative Ms. Sanderson.
Thank you. I think the idea is extremely good. The more we can make our collections and money gathering in the Oregon Health Plan, which has been a problem, better. I think it's wonderful. I would think, unless the company or that would do this, I would think that it would cost us a lot to implement or, you know, buy into a program like this. But if the incentives are right, I think that's great. So I do support looking into it.
Any other comments? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Westland?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3515, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3515 and open a work session on House Bill 2511.
Those clap?
Well, clap for Holly. Sandy. Or do you just want Holly to walk it?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2511 is what you have attached as a dash two amendment, which replaces the bill. And the amendment prioritizes populations served and benefits received by the people covered under the Oregon Health Plan. It requires approval of any waivers from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2003, and Holly's going to take us through.
Okay, I'm going
section at a time.
We'll have Holly walk through the bill, and then I'll invite. After that, I'll invite Bruce up to, while Holly's still there, to address some concerns over the technical language of the bill. So, Holly.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. Mr. Chair, is it your pleasure that I do this bill as a fresh bill, or would you also like me to contrast it to Senate Bill 540?
I think a contrast would be good, just so we know the differences.
Okay. The dash two amendments to 2511 do is basically primarily two things. It establishes a specific set of services within the definition of health services under the Oregon Health Plan to more clearly delineate in statute what services may or may not be provided to a specific population group. And the second thing it does is identify specific populations by category that would be eligible for services under the health plan. Section one of the bill modifies current Oregon law. And the definition that has been used currently or has been used to identify those services has actually showed up in two places. But the primary one for the health plan has been under health services. And you can see on page one, lines 10 to 13, how generic the language was in identifying which services were to be provided. So what this bill does primarily is take those four areas, provider services and supplies, outpatient services, inpatient hospital services, and health promotion and disease prevention, and basically specify specifically what is included in here. What those services are then would be services required by federal law to be included in the state's medical assistance program in order to qualify. Those are what are known as the mandatory Medicaid services that the state has to provide in order to be eligible to participate. The second level is primary care services that are provided by a physician or a nurse practitioner. Primary care services are basically services that are provided in the context of a family practice, an internist, sort of the opposite of specialist services. Then we have prescription drugs, lab and x-rays, medical supplies, mental health, chemical dependency, dental services, other provider services, outpatient and inpatient hospital services. The second thing that Section 1 does is clarify.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say outpatient hospital services, then, is there rules that define the types of specificity regarding what outpatient hospital services are, or does it, and also inpatient hospital services? And I'm thinking about those cosmetic type of services that a doctor can do regarding cosmetic surgery or tummy tucks or those types of things. Are those also included?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Anderson, there are already in the Department of Human Services for the Medical Assistance Program has already adopted rules defining these things.
Okay.
So they have been in existence for a long time. I think that the rules would not... Right now, the rules do not include those types of services, but I don't see anything in this list at this point specifically changing the types of services that the department would pay for under the medical assistance program. All this does is further define in statute what the categories of services would be.
Thank you.
The second part of subsection 1, subsection 2 of section 1, just clarifies that the health services that are approved and funded under subsection 1 of this section are subject to the prioritized list of health services. It's a way of connecting the prioritized list of health services with those services that are provided. Section 3, then, identifies groups of individuals who would be receive services under the medical assistance program. And this list would then include, first of all, those individuals who are, in this case, categorically needy as defined by law. And these are individuals whom, under in order to participate in the federal program, have to be served. Those are traditionally the categorical population. And then as we go down the list, we have children and pregnant women with at no more than 185% of federal poverty, adults at under 25% of federal poverty, adults between 25 and 50% of federal poverty, et cetera, et cetera. Let me identify at this point there are a number of changes between House Bill 2511, the S2 amendments, and Senate Bill 540. At this point, the two primary differences would be that subsection 1 in the definition of physician services, there are primary care services are specified as a specific type of service under 2511. Other physician services would come under provider services, but this allows for a primary care package to be developed if this legislative body were interested. It does not exclude other physician services being provided. It just breaks them down into smaller bits. That would be one way to look at it. And then the other big difference is that in Section 3, the order of this list is a little bit different. It has a lower, it doesn't take the federal poverty, it doesn't take groups, it takes groups only up to 200% of federal poverty, shifts people around a little bit, and also has a category for families, which is sub 6 of subsection of Section 3, persons 19 years of age or older living with one or more dependent children, as opposed to just couples and families. Otherwise, it's just sort of a shuffling of the other list. Section 4 identifies then, takes the category of individuals, takes the list of health services, and attempts to match them. And basically what this says is that if you are if you are categorically needy, if you are a person under 19 years of age, you are a pregnant woman with an income up to 185% of federal poverty, and if you are a pregnant woman with income between 185% and 200% of federal poverty, you will receive basically the same services that you are getting today, which are all of the services provided under subsection 1. Then, as you go through that list, other subcategories within this list then receive more specific benefit packages or benefits. Individuals in subsection 7, which is the medically needy, would be eligible for prescription drugs, chemical dependency services, mental health services, and other provider services. Adults, basically, would be eligible for things from B through K, which, again, is not to say that they're going to get everything. They're just eligible for everything subject to funds available. The other big significant policy piece in Section 4 is that it also attempts to identify packages of services that if the legislature were to fund a specific group of individuals, they would have to fund one group as there would be a single benefit package for certain groups. So, for example, in 1, 2, and 5, which again are the categorically eligible pregnant women and children, that the single benefit package for that group is A through G, which is everything through chemical dependency on the list. That the single benefit package for adults goes through chemical dependency, and then the single benefit package for medically needy would be prescription drugs.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
When you're listing these things under Section 4, say B, and you're listing persons described shall receive the health services, and then you list them in 414.705, and then you list 1, C, F, G, and I, then does that mean then that they will not be receiving benefits that are those numbers that aren't listed here? I mean, is that the intent of this bill, since I don't have the statute in front of me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence Anderson, the intent of the big picture of the bill is this. I get to use my hands. This is fun. You have a list of people, and you have a list of services. And the legislature is basically, I used to make jokes about ordering off a Chinese menu. I'm not sure I can do that anymore. It's probably not politically correct. But it basically allows the legislature to say, from column A, we're going to pick these things, which are people, and from column B, we're going to pick these things, which are services. It attempts to, and this bill is different than 540 in some significant ways, it does say if you're going to give pregnant women services or children services, there's a minimum package of services that you have to provide. And then subject to funds available, then we could give them more services, but if you're going to serve them, you can't go, there's a floor for certain groups of individuals. But it's basically a lot of mixing and matching. Because the other thing that 2511 does that's different from 540 is does not set any type of priority for increasing or decreasing populations of individuals or increasing or decreasing benefit or health services. So in the list of services, we have benefit packages. We have big benefit packages. And then we have little benefit packages, which are dental services and provider services. And then we also have healthcare services, which are inpatient and outpatient hospital services. And the legislature, if they have money to spend, can say, okay, we have to do minimum benefit according to this bill. But we can then pick and choose below that or above that, however you want to look at it, and say, we're going to add one of these and one of these, and give this population these additional benefits. What this bill does not do is say you have to pick these benefits in a particular order or these individuals in a particular order.
Question. So I guess I understand the populations. That's easy to grasp. Who then is going to determine then what benefits to pick and choose? Depending on how much money.
Representative Mona Sanderson, the legislature will have that.
And we have bills already.
That power is actually crafted within this to set the stage.
Yeah, that would be a decision matrix in the Ways and Means Subcommittee to what they
that's
buy.
That's what it is. Okay.
Yeah.
And the concept really philosophically or from a policy directive is comparable to the Health Services Commission saying, we're setting the line here, and the legislature is going to come in and saying, okay, we're going to set the other line, which in fact the legislature's always had the authority to do.
Okay.
Understand. Thank you.
Let me just finish then highlighting some differences then between this one and 540 as it came out of the Senate. This bill, it does have benefit packages of dental services being developed by the department. It has benefit packages of provider services being developed by the department. But it also gives the legislative authority the ability to increase benefit packages, health services, or populations. So what that does is that pulls in the benefit packages, the mandatory benefit packages, the pieces of the dental and the provider services, and then it also brings in the ability to add the health services, which would be that are not part of a quote-unquote benefit package, which would be inpatient and outpatient hospital services. And then the rest of the bill is primarily operative dates and effective dates and how this thing works. There was one change made to the what is basically part of the in section 9 of the bill, which amends 414-839, it would make comparable. FEOP currently has the ability, a part of their statutes, to serve people up to 200% of federal poverty. This makes that consistent with that number, but it also would allow them to serve CHIP kids up to 200% through that program as well. And with that, I would be happy to defer any questions.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a former life, I lived in a different state to the south of us, where routinely, you mentioned as long as funds last, routinely in August you could count on it that most of the services were going to go down or be gone in a lot of areas. How can we project, how accurately can it be projected that the basic services be carried through all the whole year, rather than storm out of the gates in January and then end up in later months without much to provide anything?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure that I or anybody else can answer that question. I think as a policy decision, and I think it is in this bill, I mean, one of the things that this bill does do, that 540 also does, is say that the population of eligible persons that you're serving on July 1st cannot be reduced. So basically, if this bill were enacted, if 540 were enacted, it would require the assembly or the emergency board to balance a budget looking elsewhere, but says that we, the legislature, are committed to serving this group of people through the biennium and sort of that's the policy decision that we are making. And that's the policy decision that's at this point contained in this bill. There is a floor under which the department cannot go.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. In some categories, we're going to 225%.
Not in this bill.
But it's projected that it could go there.
Not in this bill.
That's on the last draft, I assume.
Okay. That was in Senate Bill 540.
My comment would be that I would much rather see a stable bill for a fairly large number of people than huge benefits for some and not so good benefits for others. I assume those are because of CMS that
we had to go to that. No, that was just a decision matrix in the Senate committee that crafted the bill, but we go to 200% for pregnant women, and for the expansion population as it currently exists, we are going to 185. We don't go below that for children, but we do increase pregnant women. But part of the reason for keeping children at 185 is what Holly just referenced, increasing FEOP to 200, because we can pick up the children between 185 and 200 into the FEOP program. So it's not an abandonment issue. It's just a different place for the services to be delivered. Any other questions? Bruce, would you want to come up and kind of look at where you see the possibility that that, well, what we need is for Holly to convince you that she's right and you're wrong here, so, or vice versa. Yeah, but we got two lawyers there, so it's
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this morning on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I've submitted a written statement for you, and at the chair's request, I will not read all 9 pages of it. Much of what I have done has been to include for you the text of statutes that are proposed to be repealed by the amendments to House Bill 2511. And that's because I think it's important when the committee considers amendments like this that would repeal sections that you know what sections, what the substantive provisions of those sections are. So I've included the text of the statutes as footnotes, and that really does increase the volume of the testimony substantially. What I would like to do, with your permission, is just to briefly explain to the committee why it is that although the Hospital Association understands the need for adjusting the Oregon Health Plan and its coverage of benefits and populations, why it's our view that these amendments don't satisfactorily allow you to do that. Let me start with the definition of primary care services that I believe is on page 1, lines 17 and 18 of the Dash 2 amendments. You've had testimony this morning from Legislative Council about what that term means, but there is no definition in the law of what a primary care service is. And as I read the definition, or as I read the provision, it is services provided by a physician or a nurse practitioner. There is no definition that I've seen in the amendments of what a primary care service is that differentiates it from a secondary service or a tertiary service or a quaternary service or any other service. And it seems to us that if you're using terminology like that, the statute should be as specific as possible about what is encompassed within the term. Absent legislative specificity, terminology like that will be defined by the agency or ultimately interpreted by a court. And we think it would be preferable as a matter of policy if the legislature made clear what it means when it uses a term like primary care services. I use that as an example because I think it's an important example for understanding how 2511 would work. But it's not the only example of terminological issues that we think exist in the draft.
So, Bruce, is it primary care that your concern is? So, for example, if we said services provided by, you would have a higher comfort level?
Mr. Chair, I think the way I interpret that provision now, all services provided by a physician are considered primary care services. And if that's what you mean, then that means something that is broader, perhaps, than the limitation that was testified to by Legislative Council as to what she understood primary care services to be. And we just think whichever approach you're taking, the committee should be as clear as possible in the language it's using about which it means. If primary care services are all services provided by a physician, that could include very complicated tertiary care services provided in a hospital by a physician, even though normally we wouldn't think of that being primary care. So complicated surgery, if it's provided by a physician, could be primary care services. And the question is, are you intending that it be all physician services or all primary care services as a subset of physician services or something else?
Well, what we're intending there is primary care services. I mean, the main thrust of B is to define who is providing the services.
Mr. Chair, as I read that provision, it then means that any service provided by a physician or a nurse practitioner would be a primary care service.
I'm not sure I read it that way, but I mean, we're very clear and specific. Primary care services, I think, are generally understood, and those are the services we're talking about. And then we are defining by reference who is going to be delivering those services.
Mr. Chair, I believe I understand what your intent is. What I'm questioning is whether the language in the bill expresses that intent and will be clear to others who read this law, should it become law.
Okay. Thank you for your concern. I think it does, but go ahead.
Section 3 directs the Legislative Assembly to, quote, approve and fund health services to the following persons in the following order, unquote. The section then lists 9 categories, I believe, of persons as defined by either state law or by age, income, or household criteria. Thus, as I read the amendment, the categorically needy are defined in subsection 1 as those who are, quote, required, unquote, by federal law, or, quote, allowed, unquote, by DHS to be so defined. And I've set forth at the bottom of my testimony on page 3 what those statutory provisions are, so that you can see that the authority under both federal law and state law is pretty broad. Under 414.025 sub 2.0, which would be the state authority to define the categorically eligible, it could include an individual or member of a group who, subject to the rules of the department and within available funds, may optionally be included in the state's medical assistance program under federal law and regulations concerning the availability of federal funds for the expenses of that individual or group. That vests fairly broad rulemaking authority within the agency to determine who is categorically eligible. But our concern is also that there may be overlap among the categories that are defined as eligible populations. For example, subsection 9 identifies the lowest category of as adults with incomes from 76 to 100% of federal poverty without Medicare. Lower-income adults, those below 76%, are listed as higher priorities for Medicaid, whether or not they have Medicare. Under these provisions, it appears an adult on Medicare with income at 75% of poverty would be a higher priority than an adult not on Medicare with income at 76% of poverty. And that's the function of the way the lines are drawn and the definitions are defined to establish categories under the bill. Stated differently, a person with Medicare and an income at 76% of poverty would not be entitled to coverage at all unless they qualified under another subsection's provisions either as medically needy or as categorically needy.
Holly? I got a question about that, too.
Why is that set that way?
Why is it in 9 and not the others?
You mean the issue about Medicare?
Yeah. Why is it in section or in 9 and not in the other? For the adults and couples.
Adults and couples. That I don't know. It came about from an earlier conversation that I had with the department around the duly eligible population, and if it should have been carried forward in the second one, then it was my mistake.
Is there? I guess that confused me also why it was just in that one category and not in the other three adults and couples categories or wherever else. So is there a logical reason for that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Edge from OMAP, Department of Human Services. This has to do with dual eligibles and those who are provided, and maybe first I should say I don't have the full answer to this. I'm going to have to go back and research this a little bit more, but it has to do with dual eligibles and those who are provided some benefits as both Medicaid and Medicare recipients. And I'll go back and research this.
Okay, I guess the question is why that would only kick in above 75% and not below.
I will find out for you.
Okay.
Somebody?
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Lopez, and I am the administrator of the Office of Employment and Financial Benefits in the Department of Human Services. And I can explain that the dual eligible group is a group that is under 100% of the supplemental Social Security income standard, which is $557 a month. Other Medicare recipients above that standard are not eligible to participate in the Oregon Health Plan. So this is a group that is above the $557 that does not have Medicare.
Okay, so there is a logical reason for what it does in the bill here.
Correct. It adds in a group that is above the 557 standard and not eligible for Medicare.
Okay. Response?
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to raise questions so that the committee is clear as it draws lines for populations and benefits what it is it's doing. I'm not trying to advocate a specific position as to whether or not that should be done, but only whether the committee understands what it's doing.
I understand that.
In that regard, I would also point out my belief, at least, that the amendments in the definition of what is called the families category, as opposed to the adults and couples, caps their eligibility at 75% of poverty, rather than at some additional level. And in that respect would be different. It is setting a different eligibility threshold for that subpopulation of the expansion group than would be available for the adults and couples.
And that was by design with the figuring, number one, for that category of folks, those at the very lowest income levels are probably TANF eligible, and those above 75% are FEOF eligible. So that was by design. So, go ahead.
If I can continue, Section 4 directs that specified categories of persons, quote, receive, unquote, specified health services. The question here is, what's the use of that verb mean, and does receiving health services mean something, and requiring that persons receive health services means something different than that such persons are covered for or eligible for health services? If, as required by subsection 1, funds are available, does this mean that an eligible patient has a legal right to all the health services listed in that category because they're directed by law to be able to receive those health services? And further, since the subject to funds available requirement applies only to subsection 1, do the requirements in subsections 2, 3, and 4 of section 4 that health services be provided as a single benefit package, unquote, mean that eligible persons are entitled to those services regardless of the availability of funds? I'm only questioning the way the provision is drafted and how the limitation on funds availability applies only to subsection 1. Let me turn to what I think is maybe the heart of these amendments. Subsection 7 of Section 4 which is the provision at the bottom of page 3. Mm-hmm. That provision allows the Legislative Assembly to, quote, adjust health services funded under 414.705.1 by increasing or reducing benefit packages, by increasing or reducing health services, or by increasing or reducing the population of eligible persons. that authority in the Legislative Assembly exists notwithstanding 414.735, and it's my view that that provision is the heart of the Oregon Health Plan. That's the provision that I've quoted at the bottom that specifies that if there are, at the bottom of my testimony on page 4, that specifies that if there are insufficient resources during the contract period, the population of eligible persons shall not be reduced, the reimbursement rate for providers and plans shall not be reduced, and the reimbursement shall only be reduced by reducing health services in the elimination of services in the order of priority recommended by the Health Services Commission. As I read the proposed subsection 7 of section 4, this authority for the Legislative Assembly to adjust populations, benefit packages, or health services exists without regard to the Health Services Commission's prioritization. I've raised in my testimony some questions about what that provision really intends, whether it's that the Legislative Assembly, acting by bill or resolution, could make those changes, whether it can be done by the Emergency Board or the Ways and Means Committee, whether the authority of the governor is required to ratify that legislative action. But I won't detail those questions here. As I say, I think that provision is, in fact, the heart of the matter. And the question is, under that authority, would the legislature be empowered to reduce entire populations, entire categories of services, entire benefit packages, or make any other configuration that it wishes? I believe the answer is yes, if the Assembly passes a new statute that gets the governor's authority, that gets the governor's approval. Again, the question is whether that's what this language intends, or if it intends some different sort of legislative oversight or approval process than a statutory one. Under the current law, at least when there are to be changes made, I think the legislature can act through the emergency board if the agency presents a recommendation to it. And I'm questioning whether that would be allowed under this provision, or if only a bill for an act could make those kinds of modifications. To conclude the testimony, it is possible, we believe, that the intent of the proposed amendments is to eliminate many of the changes to the Oregon Health Plan that were enacted in House Bill 2519 last session. We think it's also possible that the goal of these amendments may be to eliminate the Oregon Health Plan altogether because of the way the words are written and the effect that they would have under the plan that currently functions as the Oregon Health Plan. As I expressed at the outset, the Hospital Association realizes that there may well be strong budget policy and regulatory reasons for making changes to what we've known as the Oregon Health Plan. We respectfully submit that the proposed amendments in House Bill 2511 would not make such changes responsibly. The approval of these amendments, we believe, would be the political equivalent of throwing out the tub, the bathwater, and the baby. Thank you for your consideration.
Questions? Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
Interesting, but just for the committee's benefit, the purpose of Section 7 on page 3, lines 27 through 30, is to give the Ways and Means Committee the ability to add whatever benefits they choose to whatever populations they choose without having to run through a matrix. The Senate bill, for example, would require, outside of the basic benefit package, if you're going to add something for a population, you had to do it in order, which meant you had to buy dental first, all three dental packages, on down the list, and the last two things you could buy were inpatient or outpatient and inpatient services. For some of these populations, it may be better if we get to a decision to buy outpatient, maybe emergency dental, and maybe that's what we think we can afford, and we need to have the flexibility and the ability to do that. And so that's why this change in the language here would be to give the Ways and Means Committee the flexibility based on resources to buy what we can afford and what fits best with those populations. And I guess I would also say to Representative Anderson, you know, we get into August of year two and there's no more funds. Distinct possibility, as we've discovered during all our special sessions, that funds did dry up. But I'd also point out that we base budgets on the revenue that we think is coming in for the biennium, and the Ways and Means Committee would budget inside of those guidelines for whatever they were buying to buy it for the entire biennium. So that would be the intent. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
After having sat in this committee for as many months as we've been here and sitting in on the audit committee also, I guess I just totally taken aback by the question if we are here to eliminate the Oregon Health Plan. But it seems to me that it's something that, of course, all this is new to me. I hadn't read any of this before. As I've read through this and I've heard the testimony and your concern, the people on the audit committee, it certainly doesn't seem to me it's anybody's goal to get rid of the Oregon Health Plan. But I'm wondering, I guess, if you're intending to pass this today, and if so, if maybe we could get a day or two to look at this and hear from other people about their concerns before we pass this?
Well, this is going to Ways and Means also. So it was my intent, and as I was directed to move this today. So that's my intent. You know, I am, like, personally, I'm a little concerned. I would want to make sure that the reference to Medicare in that one population is actually what needs to be there, and it doesn't need other places, but technical changes like that could be addressed. I see nothing in this bill that eliminates the Oregon Health Plan whatsoever. This is just giving us a level of flexibility. And a level of flexibility that's not available in the Senate bill that's already in Ways and Means. So we want to give the Ways and Means Committee a choice of directions to go. And so that's the intent.
Okay. If we pass it on to Ways and Means, can we also pass on our interest in what Bruce has presented here and ask him to look at it more thoroughly than we're going to be able to do today?
We will make sure that the subcommittee gets this testimony.
Great.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I'd entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendments.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2511. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel that hospitals could get killed on this, and I think it may be leading to a provider tax for them. And I really don't know the effect on the populations either. Benefits plans and crafting benefits plans, that's legislature and populations. But we're talking about talking about something so broad that I'm going to vote no, just because having had a half hour to discuss this and digest it, I am extremely uncomfortable, so I'll have to cast a no vote on this.
Okay. Any other discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Any other objections to the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2511 to the floor with a due pass with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2511 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Aye.
Representative Monica Anderson.
No.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Good bill, Mr. Chair. Aye.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. House Bill 2511, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. And for the record, we will send Mr. Bishop's testimony with the bill when it goes to Ways and Means. And I will close the work session on 2511. Thank you very much, Holly. You did a very good job on this, I think. And I'm going to open our work session on House Bill 2742. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2742 directs the Department of Human Services to obtain an independent audit of the pharmacy benefit management company used by the medical assistance program and to report the results of the audit to the Legislative Assembly. What we have before us are the Dash 2 amendments brought to us by Representative Bates, who is here to speak to them. The specifics asking the Secretary of State to contract with the organization and conduct the audit, the independent audit.
Rep. Bates, step forward and sign in.
We're like a mystery guest.
Mystery challenger.
Well, you're a mystery in a lot of ways, but you're not really a guest. So.
Left it wide open, didn't I? For the record, Representative Alan Bates from District 5 in Ashland. Mr. Chair, before you, you have the Dash 2 amendments to 2742. Just a quick few comments on this for those of the committee that may not be aware of this bill or familiar with it. First off, I'm concerned about Representative Westland's attitude this morning, as I always am on Monday mornings and Tuesday mornings and Wednesday mornings and Thursday mornings and Friday mornings. It's Libby's job on the weekend. Having said that, I'd like to go forward.
I was having an exceptional day, and
here it is.
You know, look what happened.
Now you have now you're having a very exceptional day. Okay. This is a bill which is designed to do something that's never been done in the United States. That is to audit a Medicaid PBM or PBA. PBMs and PBAs are pharmaceutical benefit managers or pharmaceutical benefit administrators, and they take care of the funding and the very complex ways we keep track of the money flowing back and forth to the federal government, the state government, the pharmaceutical industry, who actually makes the drugs, and how those payments are made. There is room in there for huge errors. On the commercial side, the products that you and I are used to seeing every day when we go to buy our own pharmaceuticals, PBMs are used heavily, and it is routine. Those PBMs in the commercial market are usually routinely audited every year for errors and to make sure that the best price is being obtained and that the company that PBMs are representing, such as Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or any other insurer, that they are getting their value. Medicaid is a different type of program which, to our knowledge, has never really been audited in the United States. There's a close attempt to it in Arkansas, but this is going to be the first real attempt to do so. The department has agreed to help support this effort. The bill itself speaks to not only an audit, but a look-back audit, because we're allowed to go back and audit as far back as 13 years under a Medicaid program, and a continuing audit in the future so that we continue to audit whatever PBM the state uses to make sure we're getting our best value. The amount of money involved in this has been left blank. I would point out to you this is matchable money by 50-50. Whatever money the state puts up for this audit is matched by Medicaid dollars as part of their administrative overhead. And so if we're putting up $75,000 or $100,000 for an audit, that would be matched by the federal government for the second half. We don't expect the audit to cost much more than that. We think that's in the ballpark of what an audit of this type would cost from talking to the people who do these audits. Point out that the budget that will be audited is in excess of $300 million. So an investment of $75,000 to $100,000 on our part is, a wise investment, certainly something done on the commercial side. I see no reason it shouldn't be done on the Medicaid side also. And I'd be welcome to take any questions that might come up with the committee, Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bates, what would happen, sort of walk us through what would happen should the audit uncover
errors, significant errors?
If significant errors occurred, we would ask for that money to be refunded to the state, to the Medicaid program. Some of that money, depending on where the errors occurred, would go back to the federal government. Some would come to us because it's a 60-40 match in a lot of the programs. We are understanding that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies actually have money set aside to take care of these errors, so there's been an error made. They disperse funds for that. We don't know for sure there's been any errors made at all. We just don't know. And we think for that reason it's more than worthwhile to start auditing this large function of the state on a regular basis. But those monies would come back to the state.
Let's be a little more succinct in our definition of errors. It's not any way to be construed as an ineptness. What it is the fact that these people really bore into details more than a PBM would, and they find things that may not have been seen on the first go around. And, you know, such simple things as a prescription for small pills rather than big pills sort of thing, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of adjustments that could be made. It's a very complicated science, so it's not that we're trying to catch anybody doing bad things. We're just trying to help them get to a higher level of efficiency.
Well put, Mr. Chair, and I would agree completely. In the commercial market, when monies are looked at, it is so incredibly complex that there's not finger pointing at. It's a matter of straightening the books out. It's more of an audited process you do like a CPA would do. I'm not really looking so much for errors. I probably shouldn't use that phrase. I'm looking for ways to make sure that the books were kept straight. And it's extremely complex. I don't know if any state government can do it on its own. They really need a PBA or PBM to do it. You might notice in the language here we use the phrase PBM or as a tool because PBAs fall within the realm of a PBM. We thought that was just simpler to use the phrase PBM.
We'll allow Representative Westland one question as long as it's germane to the discussion.
That will be difficult for him.
That would be difficult, yes.
How about a statement?
Well, that would be in character. Go ahead.
So I get a statement and a question. Don't push it, Ben. Don't push it. Alan, I really want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know you've had a great deal of interest in this for a considerable period of time, so I want to, A, compliment you and your persistence in this. And I think I was initially going to respond to Representative Belto's query with regard to the characterization of any errors. I think it's more accurate to say mistakes because, as both Chair Cruz and Representative Bates have indicated, this is very complicated, very sophisticated calculations and assumptions that go into these rebates. It's just something that not only common sense would dictate that we do, but also with a course of normal, prudent business. I mean, they just have not been audited. Not that that's a bad thing, not that that's necessarily a good thing, but I do think it's extremely prudent that we go forward with this bill. I really want to thank you, Alan, for all of your efforts over a long period of time to help ensure that this happens. And I think we've got good purchase. I know the department is starting to see the wisdom in this. So your efforts are the reason we're here and this bill's here. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been a long 2-year journey. I appreciate the support that you guys have shown for this deal. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. Do you know the ballpark fiscal that's going to be?
My expectation is that the upside on this, as far as state funds are concerned, will probably be about $75,000, which we matched with $75,000 federal government. So probably for the initial audit would be in a range of about $150,000. It could be somewhat more than that, but I expect that's the range we're talking about for the initial audit. If, in fact, we find that it's worthwhile to continue that on a continuing basis because there are financial gains for the state, of course, we would extend it at that point.
In other words, if the audit's paying for itself, we'll keep doing it.
Yeah. For instance, we have hopes of recovering millions of dollars. If, in fact, that occurs, We certainly wouldn't want to stop the audit because it's costing us $50,000 a year or whatever. I mean, that can be worked out later. We want to get the audit started first, see what the universe looks like for this, and then make a decision at that point. If, in fact, we find that there is no significant savings for the state, then that's worthwhile also, but we would probably not go forward from there. My hope is that we will find substantial savings for the state and can bring that back into the state.
Yes.
Have you had LFO look at this at all?
LFO has been an active part in this bill for the last year.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Bates. I've entertained a motion on the dash two amendment.
Move the dash two amendments.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendment to House Bill 2742. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash twos are adopted.
Who's here?
Representative Westland.
I move House Bill 2742 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Westland moves House Bill 2742 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Just a comment.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I want this program like this because I envision it paying for itself, but I still am voicing some concern regarding the fiscal impact since we don't have any money, but then this should generate some money, so catch 22 here.
Did you have something, Representative Wesson?
Well, I was just wondering if the committee had any conception at all as to, you know, here I am Monday morning, we're getting to do some important committee work, and just how impactful looking up from the dais it is on my medical treatment regimen and seeing that shiny, pointy.
Mr. Chair, I would like to point out that on a dark, gloomy day in Oregon, I'm a beam of sunlight, this man. Mr. Chair, may I be excused?
In just a second, we're all going to be excused. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Balto.
Aye.
Representative Juana Sanderson.
Aye.
Representative Comey.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2742, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Close the work session on House Bill 2742, and having no other business, for the moment, we are adjourned.